Hello and welcome to episode 90 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and I'm here as always with my long-term friend David Grigg. Hello David.
Hi Perry, how's things? Episode 90.
Good. Yeah, 90. Well, yeah. No, I'm not 90.
No. The episode.
Just
90.
The episode number.
We feel
number.
90, but yeah, we may feel 90, but we're not quite and that it's all, far yet, are we?
It's also a little bit odd in terms of this time of year, because
this is the fourth anniversary.
The fourth anniversary.
4 years we've
podcast.
Been doing it. Four years. Mm. That's a long time.
I feel so much older.
We were such innocents back then. Oh. Yeah, never mind.
Well, we were, not knowing what we were getting into and how long it was going to last. Didn't really expect it was going to be lasting this long, but it's been all right. It's been good. That's good. Yeah, there's lots to... always lots to talk about, lots to chatter about. And we can move on to some news if you don't have any other chatter.
Yeah, no, I don't have any other chatter, so roll on with the news.
No, I don't have any either. All right, news. We've got a couple of awards. It's awards everywhere, but oddly enough, not inside the science fiction and fantasy genres this time, David.
No.
We've got awards from outside the genre, and the first ones I want to talk about are the Crime Writers Association Awards, otherwise known as the DAGAs. These are the CWA is the Association of British Crime Writers, and they give out their best. The awards for the best books published in the UK in the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
We've had various winners of the Gold Dagger over the journey. Jane Harper, I think Peter Tepple's won it. Michael Rowbotham has certainly won it a couple of times. And there are a number of other different Dagger awards. There's one for spy fiction, one for historical fiction. But there's also a new Blood Dagger.
Mm.
Which is given out each year as well. So this is sort of like this is a debut.
Well, this is like New Blood, I suppose, is the thinking.
Yeah, thing. New Blood. So it's basically the first novels. Now, we've only got the short list of these so far. The winners haven't been announced. But in the New Blood Dagger Award, we have two. Dirt Town by Hayley Scrivener and Outback by Patricia Wolfe. Now, there may be others, but they're always the difficulty is with debut novels is knowing whether they're Australian or not, because, of course, these are published in the UK, so you don't know what the connections are between the publishers. So if there's any others in that list, I'm sure somebody will let us know and correct us. There aren't, that I can see, any Australian nominees in any of the others. But a couple of novels for us to keep an eye on, David, because I certainly hadn't heard of either of those.
Yeah, I think I've sort of seen them around, but I've got a copy, I think, of Outback. It was one of the books that I got from Amazon. Like, I get a free ebook from Amazon every month. And I'm pretty sure that was one of the ones that were there, and I picked it off the list. So I'll have a look.
You better read it. I'll have a read. So see what you get to. Yeah. Okay, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with them. Hopefully they do well. Good luck to them. Secondly, the Australian Book Industry Awards shortlists have been announced. In the General Fiction Book of the Year category, we have Day's End by Gary Disher from Text and Exiles by Jane Harper, Pam McMillan. We've talked about both of those books on the podcast, and I'm only going to list the ones that we've spoken about, but you were going to say?
I was going to say, I looked at the list just earlier today, and it looks to me, I may be wrong, but that every book in that general fiction category is a crime novel.
Oh.
What do you think? Is that right?
I hadn't noticed. They all look
to me to be crime books.
Oh, okay. So, well, Day's End and Exiles are certainly both crime novels, and we've talked about both of those.
Dirt Town, The Tilt, Chris Hammett's definitely going to be a crime. Exiles, right. Day's End. Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone, sounds like a crime novel.
That's
the list, so yeah, interesting.
Oh, okay. All right, that's interesting. All right, well, that looks like one to have a bit of a look at. Looks like crime fiction's starting to take over the whole of the general fiction.
Sure.
Part of Australia, I mean, it looks... okay. Well, that looks good. In the Literary Fiction Book of the Year shortlist, we have Limber Lost by Robbie Arnott from Text and a number of others, but I'm only discussing the ones here that, or mentioning the ones here that we have discussed on the podcast.
Yep.
And the small publishers adult book of the year category, we have Cold Enough for Snow by Jessica Au, or Au. That was a novella that got a lot of notice last year and this year. One that I thought was very well written, but basically instantly forgettable because it sort of doesn't start anywhere and go start somewhere, but just doesn't go anywhere, unfortunately. The other three, Days End, Exiles, and Limber Lost, we all gave very favorable reviews to, as I recall. Number three of the awards are the Australian Book Design Awards for 2023. Again, the shortlists here have been released. And we're pleased to note that friend of the podcast, W.H. Chong, has received three, count them, three nominations this year.
Very
In the Best Designed Literary Poetry Cover for Salonika Burning by Gail Jones. Best Designed Non-Fiction Cover for Childhood by Shannon Burns. And also his own book that he created himself, Dear Creatures, is also nominated in the Indie Books category.
Excellent.
So
Well done.
he's done very well,
Indeed.
as usual.
Indeed.
He's always up there, and so he should be. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. Well, I'm a bit surprised that Limber Lost didn't get up there because I thought that was an excellent cover. But hey, who
Who are
knows,
we to
David?
judge, yes.
Who are we to judge any of these things? And to finish up our news, we had the sad news of the death of Lee Harding, who was a major science fiction writer in the 1960s, published a lot of his work early in the UK prose scenes, and then wrote a number of novels. He was born in 1937 and died on the 19th of April. He was one of the co-founders of the Melbourne Club and went on to win two Ditmar Awards in the 1970s, as well as the Australian Children's Book of the Year for Displaced Person in the late 70s, early 80s, I believe. So that's the end of an era with Lee Harding. And that's the end of my news, David. Anything from you?
No,
Any
I'm not
news?
good at picking up news these days. I'm not reading enough, widely enough, and I think anyway. You do such a good job, Perry. Why should I worry?
Well, it's just all the stuff that comes over the bloody emails, David. You end up starting to get to, you just start getting interested in something, and then basically it all starts rolling in. But I do want to bring up one more thing before we get started about what we've been reading and watching lately. And I was reading something today, and I should have taken a note of it, but I didn't. It's always the way. But somebody from a university in Queensland, I believe, has been doing some mathematical determinations on the grandfather paradox of time travel. Now, as you know, this is the grandfather paradox is the idea that you invent yourself a time machine, go back and shoot your grandfather. How does that work? How do you even exist if you've shot your grandfather? How can that work? Well, they don't actually give a specific answer to that, only to say that once your grandfather has died, your motivation for going back and killing him has also died, and you're ceased to exist. So maybe you just disappear. But what they're basically trying to say is that the timelines will try to right themselves, come back to a standard sort of line. So, for example, the other example they gave was that if you decide that you have identified who patient zero was for COVID-19, and you go back in time and attempt to ensure that patient zero does not catch COVID-19, however that occurred, and I've got no theories about how it happened, but if you stop that person catching COVID-19, did COVID-19 ever exist? Well, their explanation is that yes, it always still would. And it may well be that in you stopping that person from catching COVID-19, that you take over that role of patient zero and become get infected.
There doesn't seem anything new in all of this, Perry. I mean,
no,
science fiction has dealt with these ideas for decades.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, but all they're saying is we now have a mathematical proof. If you have a think about that last one, what I was talking about, that scenario of you going back and trying to stop the COVID-19 patient from catching COVID-19, but you end up taking over, becoming patient zero. That's exactly the same plot as Behold the Man from Michael Moorcock, where he goes back to try and meet Jesus of Nazareth and finds out that Jesus is mentally impaired and basically is not able to undertake his inverted commas role in history. So the time traveler takes over his role and ends up going all the way.
But not deliberately. Well, he finds himself nudged into the role. Yeah, it's very clever. It's a good book.
Gets that thing right through to the end, and so he in effect, in terms of the way history looks at it, takes over the role.
Mm.
So
interesting.
Yes, as you say, there have been lots of solutions to the grandfather paradox, and a lot of them have been taken over by, have been written about in science fiction. So none of this stuff is terribly new, but it's just weird that it's coming up into mathematics, and I still can't work out how you can prove that. But anyway,
who knows?
It was a very thin article, but I just thought I'd bring it up.
Interesting.
I'll just skate over it now. Sorry, I mentioned it.
It's interesting you did. It's interesting that the scientists are looking at this stuff, but as I say, the ideas have been tossed around for so many years. There are all sorts of different solutions.
I think this is just one of those exercises you do when your day job is driving you up the wall and you want to think about something else. Because really, I'm of the view that time travel is never going to work.
Oh, no, of course not.
I think we live in an instant of a slither, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just moves.
Yeah. Did you see the third season of The Umbrella Academy?
Yes,
yeah, yeah, because in that, the grandfather paradox destroys the entire universe. If you remember, yes.
Yes. Well, that's a good way of stopping you from actually
going back in time and
kill your grandfather.
The whole universe collapses.
That's right. But I always like those stories where from the 1950s and 60s in the American prosans where, you know, some bloke decides he's having an argument with his wife. He thinks, right, that's it. I'm going into the basement and invent a time machine and go back and kill her. So he does. And you think, wow, that was pretty quick. Why couldn't we all do that? Yeah. Not go back and kill your wife. No. Just invent the time machine.
In the basement.
What the heck? Anyway. But it's interesting that, and forgive me if I'm wrong, because it's been so long since I've read The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. Does he ever go back in time, or does he only ever go forward? Well,
the impression you get is that at the very end of the book is that he has gone back, but he never returns from going into the past.
Oh, okay. Mm. All right. Okay. Yes, it's the one where you go back into the past and you get there and you go, right, time to go home, and you find out that...
You just stood on a butterfly and...
No, the PowerPoint's come out of the socket. And there's no power for you. So you have to make that tip for time travellers. Make sure it's self-powered. It's got to have a completely encased power supply. If you try and run it through the household electricity system, you may be in a bit of trouble at the other end.
Well.
Or take a very long cable. That's what
funny.
Right. Okay.
Let's start talking about what we've been reading.
That's enough frivolity. Yeah. Leah, let's talk about what we've been reading lately. Okay. And you're going to start off with The Mountain in the Sea by Ray Naylor.
I am. Which I believe is a debut novel. He's written and published quite a lot of short stories, but I think this is his first novel by the look of what it says in the book anyway.
I think so. I should mention that it is actually on this year's Nebula ballot, and I have put it on my nomination ballot for the Hugos for this year.
Me too.
As to whether it's going to get up,
don't know.
But anyway,
it was nice to see it. Yes, I did the same. Yeah. All right. So, well, let's talk about the book. So it's a first contact novel, I guess, but it's got a definite twist. What if the alien species with which we need to communicate is already here? On Earth, or rather in the ocean. And that's the core premise of the book. So it begins some decades into the future, and a lot of it's set in the archipelago of Con Dao, I presume that's how you pronounce it, Con Dao, off the shore of Vietnam. And this area was meant to be an oceanographic wildlife reserve, but because of local poverty and the corruption of officials, it's continued to be fished and exploited until it's taken over by a huge corporation called Dyanima, established by Dr. An Katla Minervudotir Chan. I'm trying to pronounce that carefully. Dr. An Lata Minervudotir Chan, who has dedicated her life to in trying to create artificial mines. Dyanima evacuates all the local population from Con Dao and takes extraordinary measures to keep out those who wish to exploit the ocean around it, and it establishes a research station there. Now, the book's main point of view character is Dr. Ha Nguyen, who's a scientist in her 40s. And the novel contains many quotes, like the beginnings of each chapter, contains many quotes from Ha's book, How Oceans Think. But we're introduced to her as a character when she's recruited by Dyanima and airlifted to their research station on Con Dao. Here she meets two other characters who play a large role in the story. In fact, much of the story really is about the personal dynamics between three women. And so we have Ha Nguyen, and then she meets on the island. The first person she meets on the island is Alt Antseg. Some of these names are very hard to pronounce. Altansetseg, who's the station's Mongolian security officer. And she's a powerful figure who's fought in several wars and has the scars to prove it. The other character in the drama on the island is Evrim. Now, Evrim is Minervudotir Chan's greatest creation, a genderless android with apparently completely human consciousness and even greater intelligence. Such is the fear that is raised in the popular mind that many countries forbade Evrim to enter their borders and passed laws against creating further such creatures like this one. Now, Ha's attempts to understand Evrim's thoughts and feelings are a key part of the book. There's a lovely passage I picked out which I'd like to quote. So here's a quote from the book. In the lobby, Evrim sat alone, face lit by the glow of a terminal, surrounded by all the gear and tech Alt Antseg was constantly tinkering with. And Ha had a clear image of Pinocchio on the shelf, ranged among the inanimate dolls that were its ancestors, suspended between the worlds of the living and the inanimate, subject and object, struggling to become real. I think that's a nice quote. Would be nice if I could have read it a bit more clearly, but never mind. So Ha soon finds out why she's been recruited and taken to Con Dao. Just offshore from the research station, deep in murky water, is the sunken wreck of a large ship, which has now been completely taken over by underwater life, including a group of octopuses, which are exhibiting unexpected behavior, certainly for octopuses, and perhaps, just perhaps, it's intelligent behavior. So Ha is excited by the possibilities of communicating with a species utterly unlike ourselves. She and Evrim work together to try to make sense of what they're seeing while Alt Antseg operates lethal firepower to destroy fishing vessels attempting to enter the protected zone. There are dark forces at work, however. One of these forces recruits a Russian hacker to try to find a way into a complex network. He's just given this access and told to see if it can break into this network in order to take it over. But we eventually learn that this complex network is in fact Evrim's mind. We also follow the story of Aiko, who has been press-ganged to work as a slave on an AI-controlled fishing vessel named the Seawolf. The intelligence controlling the vessel is locked behind steel plates. The human slaves have replaced the robots previously on board the vessel simply because humans are cheaper to replace if they die than the robots are. So the profit motive rules everything. So Dr. Nguyen knows that it's going to be almost impossible in the long run to protect the octopuses on Con Dao from the exploitation of such fishing vessels, even if she can prove that the octopuses have reached a level where they're building their own culture. And the story comes to a head when Dr. Minervudotir Chan herself arrives on the island and tells them that a hostile takeover of her company, Dyanima, is underway, and she doesn't know if it can be stopped. But without Dyanima's protection, it's all too likely that Con Dao will be quickly exploited and stripped bare, intelligent octopuses or no. And at the end, there's a nicely unexpected twist, I thought. So I like this a lot. The relationships between the characters are full of interest, and it's one of those books that really makes you think about all these themes, you know. What is it that makes us human? What does consciousness mean? How can we create a true artificial intelligence? And if we did, what would its life be like? How can we communicate with a truly alien species which is physically completely unlike our own? So yeah, I thought it was very good. I really enjoyed the book, and as, like you, I popped it on the my Hugo nomination list. I'd like be very happy to see it pop up on the ballot.
Actually, there's two first contact threads going through this.
Well, true.
Yes, you've got, but and it's interesting to look at the contrast between the two of them, because you've got the first contact with the first android, who, while they have had most of their mental processes mapped from a large number of people, supposedly. You've also got a situation where nobody's come across a creature like this before, and this creature is trying to find their own way in the world, and trying to determine what their purpose is and what they should be trying to do. And so you have that conversation going on land, and then offshore, you're starting a conversation with these seemingly intelligent sea creatures, and it's very interesting that he's picked up on these particular creatures, because if you think about it, when you first said that humans are making contact with an intelligent species in the oceans, a lot of people might have thought that they were going to be either whales or dolphins. But the interesting thing about the octopus is that they have a very strange bone structure, but they have an eye very, very similar to our own. But they also have basically, well, tentacles that act like hands in a lot of ways. And so they are able to manipulate things with a very fine level of detail. As is discovered by a number of the people, well, the people on the island, when they start finding things. And then they start realizing that some of the decorations around the areas where the octopus are living are very precise in terms of their patterning. And they have to try to determine, is this a form of communication or not? And if so, what does it mean? And there's some very interesting discussions here about, well, okay, if it is a form of communication, you can't look at it as being, say, like you and I talking to a person from another race in another language, say Tibetan or Mongolian, or even talking to the android. I mean, here you're talking to a creature that's living in a completely alien environment, one in which they have adapted perfectly, in which we are really not all that well adapted to. And the way that your environment is always going to basically determine how your language is going to be created, right from the base level up. And if we are looking at a new species that's developing a language from the base level up, they could start in a complete and utterly different place. Or they might start almost in the same place, but using a vastly different method of looking at that place and then spreading out from there. So it's a very, very interesting set of discussions here about communication between intelligent species, and it was that helps carry it quite a lot. This is not exactly a short
No,
book.
it's quite long.
I've got my book here. What is it? About 450 odd pages. Now, as you say, there are three main threads in this, and one of the threads really doesn't join up with the other two until quite late in the piece. And to me, and forgive me if this is, I'm not going to give away any spoilers here, but aches for a sequel. It really does. It doesn't.
Yes.
I don't. While I can see that he has completed everything that he needed to do in this particular novel, there are enough threads here that can spread out just that little bit further down the timelines for the characters, and also for the situation that's occurring, for there to be at least one more
Yeah,
book in
it's
this.
possible. We can hope for that.
Well, we can hope for it. And I hope I'd haven't heard whether he has Naylor has decided that he's going to write a sequel. I just hope that he does, and I hope that this is going to get a fair amount of a fair amount of coverage and a fair amount of readership, because I think it is a I think it's an excellent novel, and I think that I'm hoping that it will do very well.
The other theme which we haven't mentioned, which is I think it's worth adding at this stage, is the strong environmental message, because when you look at what we've done to the oceans and what we've done to the octopuses, we are the monsters. They must see us as these evil gods. And there's definitely that kind of message in there as well. So yeah, anyway, we've talked enough about it, but it's a very good book, and we can both recommend it, I think.
Yes, the whole concept of these AI-driven fishing vessels that are out there just to strip mine the whole of the oceans for any protein they can get is really quite
Yeah, it
scary.
is.
And the way that they've and the way that they've been developed and then implemented is not something to look forward to at all. This is a very harrowing sort of sequence in the book when you realise what's going on in terms of not only how they deal with the slave crew, but also what they're doing to the oceans. And it's just relentless. It's all a matter of I want it and I want it now, and I don't care what's going to happen next week, let alone what's going to happen in 20 years' time. So
And that's why capitalism must be destroyed.
you said it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
Okay. So we both agreed that that's
that's a
one of our
good.
favourites from last year. Yes, I think it is. While I haven't finished it yet, I have started Babel by R.F. Quang, which you've read and
I liked.
you liked. I've read enough of it to put that on my list, and I also put Sea of Tranquility on my nominating ballot. So they were the only three novels that I read f that from last year, with the proviso I haven't finished Babel yet. But I think that hopefully those three will make it onto the list. But this is a very strange year, David, and I have no idea what's going to be
I
there.
did wonder about The Mountain and the Sea and how well it would go down in China, because it does feature the Tibetan Buddhist Republic,
Oh yes,
which might
that's a
not
very good
go down
point.
too well in China.
No,
The Tibetan
that's
Buddhist
right.
Republic,
And
yeah.
that was a very. I saw that. When I was reading that, and I was thinking, oh yeah, this is a bit of a sly dig.
Yeah,
I
is
don't
it
think the
what?
Chinese Chinese government's not going to like it very
Yeah,
much.
anyway,
They
that's it.
may. Oh, that would be interesting. They may, in fact, if they come across it, they might
They
ban
might
it.
ban it.
But again, this may be a situation of if you, as you recall, when we were talking about the Stragatskys, I think that one of the things that was brought up in my research when I was was reading about the Stragatskys was they were trying to write politically critical novels of novels critical of the Soviet system, but they couldn't do it with realistic novels, so they wrote science fiction novels, and the powers that be sort of thought, oh yeah, well this isn't real, so this is okay. And they got away with it. But you need to be able to read the metaphors, and you need to be able to read between the lines. In Naylor's book, you don't need to read it between the lines because it stands up and punches you right in the
That's right.
face. So there's a he may have a bit of a problem there. I haven't heard of any, but it would just be interesting to see. It will be interesting to see. All right. Okay, I'm going to move on. I've recently read Treacle Walker by Alan Garner. I believe you've read this
No, I haven't.
last
I've
year.
got I've
You
got
haven't
I've
read
got
it.
it as an e-book, but I have not yet read it.
You keep on telling me that you're going to read it, and I
Well,
thought, oh, well, you
no, I
must
haven't
have
got
read it
around to
by
it,
now,
no,
but you
not yet.
haven't.
But
Okay, so,
go ahead, go, don't
all
worry
right,
about
okay.
me.
Well, Alan Garner, for those that aren't in the know, has been writing since at least since the 70s. I'm not sure if he
Sixties,
published in
I
the
think, yeah.
60s. 60s, I think. The major ones that I recall from his earlier part of his career were novels such as Red Shift and Owl Service. Now, these were ostensibly marketed as, well, they're juveniles, as they were called back then, as you recall, David, but now are referred to as young adult novels, which is probably a far better term. these were novels that were really quite difficult and really quite strange, and but very, very interesting to read. Redshift in particular had a lot of jumps to it, and I seem to recall it a difficult one to understand. It was one of those ones that made you think, I have no idea exactly what's going on here. But Alan Garner is a, I recall, I haven't read anything by him for about 20 odd
Yeah,
years.
me neither.
And so the interesting thing about this book was it was shortlisted for the 2022 Booker Prize. Now, a friend of the podcast, Lucy Sussex, has told me that she thinks that was because genre writer M. John Harrison was actually on the judging panel, and he pushed to have this particular book included. Now, it's a short novel, 150, 160 odd pages, but it's not densely written. The font is really quite large, which is for old codgers like us, David, quite a good thing to be reading. But anyway, I was very interested to find this in the library, and I picked it up. And Alan Garner's still writing peculiarly strange books. So anyway, just to give you an idea about what this book's about. So the main character for this particular book is a kid by the name of Joe Kopok. I'm not totally sure exactly how old he is, but he's about 11 or 12, somewhere around there. And he's a young, introspective boy living with a dodgy eye that he's basically trying to cover over with a patch. And he lives in a cottage in the countryside, presumably England somewhere. Now, one day he's sitting at home because he likes to sit at home and read his comics. These are comics that are like the 1960s and 1970 English comics, like Eagle and Beano, but they're not called that. They're called something a little bit different, but that sort of thing. And one day he's visited by a rag and bone man who goes by the name of Treacle Walker. And from then on, his life takes a strange turn into the fantastical. He encounters a green man from traditional English folklore in a nearby copse. He discovers the real reason why his eye is the way that it is, and he has strange adventures with a set of characters from the comic book he loves to read. He seems to fall into their universe through a mirror and then back out again. And it all seems a bit mad and incomprehensible overall, and at times you just have to let it all flow over the top of you so that you can get a bit of an idea about how it goes. There's a lot of strange language used, strange words that are used, but it doesn't take all that long to read. It's only about 160 pages, and you can read it in one or two sittings, which is what I suggest that you do. Don't leave it for a long period. Pick it up and read a big chunk of it first, and then come back and read it again. If you don't like the first half, don't worry about it. Just go on and read the second bit, because it's the whole of the story that you're after, not the individual little scenes that might you might find a little bit difficult. The story starts to take shape around about the time that you finish with it, and it almost demands an immediate rewrite. Unfortunately, I had to get it back to the library, so I can't reread it straight away. But I really should go back and read it again. Now, I don't think there's anybody around that writes like Garner at all. I
No,
can't think of anybody, and it seems just weird that it has picked up so much kudos that it did last year. But I'd read this book for the flow of the language, the use of the story, and read it for the weird and beguiling story that it is, and the way that only Alan Garner can present. I thought this was excellent. Gave it 4.3 out of five, and it'll be one of my favourites for the year, I
Okay,
think.
well, so it's been sitting there as an ebook. I think that's actually sometimes an ebook puts me off. If I'd actually had it as a physical book, I think I would have read it by now. But
Oh,
I've
yeah.
got so many ebooks sitting there on my reader that it becomes a matter of the choice is hell, as to what I'm going to read next. So, but I will.
Yep.
I'll put it higher on the list.
And we have to be careful about e-readers as well, because as we mentioned last time when we were talking about Life After Life, I found that I wanted to go back and relook at
Yeah.
things going back to be able to work out where it was, because it's easy with a physical volume to actually go and look at the chapter headings at the front if they're included, so you can see where it all sort of fits, and you can see the flow, and you can jump backwards and forwards a lot easier. With an e-book, it's just sort of fairly linear. I mean, they're very, very useful for what they are, but
Yeah.
they do have limitations from that regard.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Particularly when I'm doing reviews, there are benefits to both. And sometimes it's good to have a copy of both in both formats, which I actually did with Life After Life. I had the ebook, and then I actually went out and bought the hardback, because, as you say, it's easy to flip back with a physical book. But the beauty of an ebook is that you can search. Like, certainly with my aging brain, if I can, put in the name of a character. Now, who is that character again? It sounds familiar, but it must have come earlier in the book. Who was it? Where did they come in? Put a search in there. Search. Oh, that's where that person comes from. Yeah.
Okay.
So I find it helpful to have the ebook sometimes, and helpful to have a physical book. So if you could afford it, have both. Yeah. Anyway.
The author will love you
That's
for it.
right, that's right. Well, I'm saying that in particular because the book I'm about to talk to next, I bought as a paperback, but in fact it would have been useful to have had the ebook as well. Anyway, now that's the book I'm going to talk about is Cold Water by Dave Hutchinson. Now I'm going to do a fair bit of background here, because this is a standalone addition to Hutchinson's Fractured Europe series, which I read and enjoyed a few years ago. That series comprises four books: Europe in Autumn, Europe at Midnight, Europe in Winter, and Europe at Dawn. And the series shares two very interesting premises. Firstly, the idea that a few decades from now, following a deadly pandemic which shattered government institutions, a largely united Europe has broken up, not only into individual nations, but further into smaller and smaller provinces and regions, splitting away from their parent countries and declaring independence, almost to an absurd level. So, from a Europe with no internal borders to one with hundreds of borders. So, while that might be a bit improbable, you can certainly imagine this scenario playing out in some form in the future. But interestingly, the earlier books in the series came out well before both Brexit and COVID occurred, so it was fairly prescient, I think. Anyway, in this scenario of a fractured Europe, being able to discreetly move valuable items and sometimes people from one place to another becomes a sought-after skill, and this gives rise to an organization calling itself Les Coureurs des Bois, which means the runners of the woods. What they do isn't necessarily illegal, but that depends on where you're standing, and they're certainly frowned on by many governments. So there's a definite flavor of the spy thriller in these books. So that's the first premise, this fractured Europe. The second premise, however, is an utterly fantastic one, and that's the idea that back in the early 1800s, a family of map makers started to draw highly detailed maps of an imaginary English county they called Earnshire, and it came into being as a kind of pocket universe alongside our own. It's a wacky idea, but I love a wacky idea if the author can carry it off, which I think Hutchinson does. I can see Perry shaking his head, he didn't like it. But this family weren't content to have created their own English county, but they moved on to draw magical maps of Europe. And by the time that our version of Europe has splintered up, there's a huge secret region lying beneath it, or alongside it, whatever you like to say, ruled by the descendants of the map-making family. Still largely English and semi-rural, and they call themselves the Community. But by the time this novel, Cold Water, opens, the existence of the Community is no longer secret, and indeed some degree of trade goes on between the countries of our Europe and the Community, though the latter strictly controls access to its territory, and there are only a few known crossing points. So let's get on to this actual novel, Cold Water, which has a number of point of view characters, all of them female. We start with Carrie Chews, a woman in her late 50s, and she was once one of the Coureurs de Bois, but left the organisation years ago. But now she's contacted and asked to investigate the death of a man called Maxim in a car accident in eastern Poland. Now, long ago, Maxim recruited Carrie into the Coureurs and also became her lover. His death seems straightforward. Maxim was driving at very high speed in a rural area and slammed into a tractor and was killed instantly. But of course, there's more to it than that. Carrie assembles a team of young people to help her investigate. We're also introduced to Krista, who's a police inspector in Tallinn in Estonia, who was suspended from duty after being told that her father, who was also a senior police officer, has recently been accused of having covered up crimes and committed murders while he was at work. Her father's now dead, and Krista can't believe these accusations. So although she's forbidden from interfering in the investigation, she does start to make her own inquiries. We also have Lena, an out-of-work journalist who's recruited to help promote the cause of a Russian man who it's claimed was killed some years ago by police in Tallinn, among them Krista's father. Her publicity campaign causes great problems for the local authorities. So all of these stories are connected, of course, and eventually they come together to what I thought was a satisfying conclusion. I quite enjoyed the book, but I do have a big criticism, and that's that it's often not clear which of these three women's stories we're following at a particular point in time. Throwing the fact that we've got quite a lot of flashbacks into Carey's earlier life, and the fact that, as we discover much later, Krista and Lena's timelines are set a decade or so earlier than Carey's main story, and there's just too much scope for confusion, for my aging brain anyway. I'm sure that I'd appreciate the book much more on a second read, but I'm not prepared to do that for a while. I am, however, now tempted to go back and reread the earlier books in the series and see how it all connects up together.
Oh, David.
You didn't like David, it at all, did you?
No, I can understand. I can understand why you'd want to, but who's got time?
Oh, it's true, but still, temptations.
I know. Yeah. All right, okay. But, if you're that tempted, yes, go ahead.
The interesting thing was that having said that I found this a bit confusing, and that I might go back and reread the earlier books, is I actually looked up the earlier review I did of the first three books in the series, because the fourth one hadn't come out. And that says, I had to reread these books twice in order to make sense of them. It was so confusing.
I think that's asking a bit of
the reader
to sort of go back. I mean, I was talking about Trigger Walker before, about sort of saying that it sort of almost demands a reread, but that's because you look at it and go, "Oh, okay, now I know how it works. I want to go and
see how it came together."
See the flow of it, and see how he brings it together, rather than what the hell was that? Yeah. I need to go back to work out what's going on. You know, tell me the first time, guys. You know, I don't want to have to go through.
Yeah. Well, I have another example of that coming up, so I'll let you go on to your next book, and then I'll talk about that.
All right, okay. Well, I'm moving on to a science fiction novella. Now, this is, I'll say what it is. It's Prayer for the Crowdshy from last year by Becky Chambers. This is the second in the author's Monk and Robot series of novellas, and it's already appeared. It's already appearing on the 2023 Nebula ballot for best novella. If I was to be a betting man, I'd put $5 on the fact that this is a shoe-in to appear on the Hugo Award ballot as well. And for the life of me, I can't work out why. Okay, so this novella continues the adventures of the genderless monk Sibling Dex and the robot Mosscap, after the robot became the first of its kind to contact humans in centuries. That first contact between Mosscap and Sibling Dex was covered in the first novella of this particular series. And that novella seemed to be setting up something quite interesting. Sorry, I said shy because I suddenly remembered that the name of the first novella was a psalm for the wild built. I always used to think it was well built, but it was wild built. Now, something seemed to be setting up of interest in that first one. It seemed, you know, it was a good setup. There was the idea that the robot had actually chosen this particular person, they were coming along quite well and starting to almost as a first contact novella. But this one just doesn't seem to go anywhere. Well, it goes places, but that's all it does. It just walk. They walk. They walk from one place to another. They talk to a few people in one town, and they talk to a few people in another town, and they move on somewhere else. And then they go back to where Dex actually came from, and though he hasn't been there for a very long time, and, you know, left acrimoniously, everybody loves him and everybody thinks everything's fantastic. And it's, you know, a sort of home on the range where never a discouraging word was heard, you know. It sort of just reminds me of the fact that, you know, can somebody have a bloody argument with somebody? Can somebody just disagree with somebody?
Is there with a bit of conflict, do you think?
A bit of conflict somewhere. There isn't any in this. This reads more than anything else like the second quarter of a much longer novel. It's like you get the impression that she's in the process of writing a novel which is going to be four novellas long, and this is the second of those. So what you've got is the very first setup, and now all they're doing is that it's moving through the landscape. I'm assuming the next one's got to be moving through the landscape, but they may in the next one discover where they're going. And then in the fourth one, they might actually be there and actually get there. So you get to the fourth one, you think, oh, finally, something's going to be going on. Now, that would be okay if it was actually in a novel, but not really very good where it's supposed to be a standalone story. When I'm trying to read this and read it as if it should make no difference as to whether I've read the first story or not, I should be able to come in there and read this as it is. And if that's the case, it's not really very good. I gave this 2.4 out of 5. This is a tedious story to me. It just goes on and on and on. They have discussions which don't seem to go anywhere. They may learn a little bit about themselves and their respective places in the world, but it hardly makes for an interesting story overall. It would add to the build-up inside a novel, but not in a story as a standalone. So, unfortunately, this is another one of those stories that fits under the term of hope punk. And as I've stated before, I find that a terrible phrase or a terrible descriptor. I can understand why people want to read this stuff because they come away with it feeling good. But I come away from a story that I want to come away from a story where I thought, oh, well, that was interesting. Something happened and there was a bit of conflict and that was a good... nothing here. There's nothing. So, I mean, I gave it 2.4 because, yeah, it's well written and I think I know what she's attempting to do. But this part of it just shouldn't have been standalone. And so I'll be interested to see whether my view about where it's going to end up going actually comes to fruition. But I'm going to have to keep reading these, David, because they keep turning up on the awards list. And I'm a glutton for punishment, you
I
know
don't
that.
think I will be doing that.
No, I can't see it. I wouldn't recommend you read
No.
this
I
one.
think we both agree that we don't see, we can't understand what people see in Becky Chambers' writing, but never mind.
No,
Some
no.
people like it.
The first novel, Long Journey to a Small Angry Planet, I thought great title and a good, okay novel. But the rest of them since, don't get it.
No,
Anyway,
no.
there you go.
All right. Well, I'm going to roll on to talk about Dead Lions by Mick Herron. Now, I know that Perry's read this and both of us have seen the TV series. But let me just go back a bit. So this is the second in the series of books by Mick Herron about this particular department of MI5, you might say, which is loosely called Slough House. And the people... It's a division of MI5 where failed spies are sent in the hope, presumably, that they'll eventually get so bored and pissed off that they'll resign. So the people who work there are dubbed Slow Horses. And Slough House is run by the idiosyncratic, acerbic, foul-mouthed, and generally disgusting Jackson Lamb, who's in his 60s. So the books, as I said earlier, the books are in the process of being turned into a very successful TV series on Apple TV Plus, with Gary Oldman doing a brilliant job in the role of Jackson Lamb. And there have been two seasons released so far, and the second season is based on this book, Dead Lions. But as I found out after reading the book, the TV show is only very loosely based on this book and includes some what I thought were very confusing elements which aren't there at all in the book. I'm wondering if they've brought forward some material from the third or later books in the series to pad this one out. Wasn't sure.
I couldn't tell you because I haven't read
No.
anything up past number
Yeah.
two.
Well, there's two sort of major chunks which I won't bother identifying, but which certainly not there in the book. But why they did this, I can't understand. Because as I wrote at the time when I was writing about the TV series, I found the plot of the second season quite difficult to follow. Matters are much simpler and easier to understand in the book. I'm really glad I read the book, which is not to say that the plot of the book is simple, only that it makes much more sense than what I saw on TV. So let's get to the plot. Perry's already discussed the book on the podcast, so I'll try not to go too long. So it starts off with the triggering incident is the death of a long since retired spy called Richard Bauch, Bouge, jokingly known to all as Dickie Bow, which is a British slang term for a bow tie. Dickie's found dead on a bus on the way to Oxford. Jackson Lamb thinks there's something suspicious about it and sets out to investigate. His staff, wondering what the heck Jackson Lamb's doing, get themselves involved. Dickie, it seems, may be a link to a Russian spy master from the Cold War era, a spy master who may or may not have actually existed. And this spy master was reputed to have set up several sleeper agents in Britain who have spent years pretending to be ordinary British citizens waiting to be triggered and put into action. A second thread, which of course eventually comes together with the first, is to do with two of Lamb's staff being seconded by an ambitious character called James Webb from Regent's Park, the main MI5 headquarters. And their job is to facilitate a meeting with a Russian oligarch called Arkady Pashkin, ostensibly to talk about an oil deal, but really because Webb thinks he can recruit him as an agent. The job sounds straightforward, but of course, things go badly wrong. Now, there's a really interesting, to me, quite unexpected plot, even after seeing the TV series. Quite an unexpected plot develops through the book. You know, nothing is quite as it seems. I really enjoyed this considerably more than I did watching the TV show, because, I say, the story in the book just seems to make a lot more sense all around. I think what I'll be doing is I'll be reading the other books in the series before the TV seasons drop, and we'll see how I can compare them then. So, yeah.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah, I really enjoy this one. I recommend it, and presumably the other books in the series. Yep.
The major thing I liked about this this one over the first was that you get a lot more about Jackson Lamb in this. He's much more of an upfront character. He's got his foibles. He tries to give you the impression that, you know, he's so complacent because he's above it all and he knows everything that's going on. But he doesn't really know everything that's going on. Mm. But he figures it all out in the end. But it's a sort of circuitous route that he has to take to be able to get there. It's very, very well done. Mm. They're quite funny. Lamb is basically building up to be one of those great modern literature characters, I think.
Yeah, he's like Falstaff or Pickwick or someone like that, really.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, we were talking about the TV series, played by Gary Oldman, who also played George Smiley in the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the most recent film version from about a decade ago. And so he's at both ends of the spectrum with spy masters in this. One where he's got the sort of genteel, aloof, intellectual Smiley, and the other one where, you know, I think there's one stage is in there where he actually is sitting on a park bench and he falls asleep with his coffee cup in his hand and he wakes up and finds coins in it because he's so slovenly that people think he must be a tramp. And he just looks at it and goes, hey, okay, takes the money, goes off and buys himself another coffee. It doesn't bother him in the slightest. It is. It's just absolutely... just absolutely wonderful. Mm. And as I said, it was. I got my wife onto reading it, but she loves them. She thinks they're just astoundingly good. The plots are intricate, which is what you want from an espionage thriller. You don't want anything just to sort of be very simple and work its way through. You want it to be intricate. You want there to be betrayals. You want the wrong people to be suspected. You want to be led down the garden path and go, no, hang on, and pull yourself back onto line again. It's great. You get all of that. And he's a master writer in terms of what he's doing. And it's about 8 or 9now, I think.
I think so, yeah.
So I'm going to have to start catching up in a big way. 1 or 2 a year, I think, David, and that'll do me. My wife will probably try and read 8 in a row, as she always does, and just plough through them and then sit back and... Wonder why I'm taking so long to catch up.
He's written an earlier series too, which I think start with something called Down Cemetery Road.
Don't know.
It'd be interesting to sort of backtrack to those at some stage too. If one only had
time. It would be. Yeah. If we had time, yes. Because, of course, I've got my next 4 or 5 years set up with my espionage novels reading these, so that'll be fine.
Okay.
Now, we were talking about tension and... conflict with the Becky Chambers novella. Well, I'm going to go from the ridiculous to the sublime and now talk about Double Indemnity by James M. Cain. Khan, Cain. This is a novella, a short novel from 1936. It's on the list of the best ever Guardian 1000 novels, and a lot of people would know it from the classic film noir version directed by Billy Wilder, featuring Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck from 1944. But it's interesting to read this particular version of the story and to note the subtle differences between the two. The endings are very, very different, which is interesting. The basic setup's the same. So I'll tell you. So there's an insurance agent, played by Fred McMurray in the film, falls for the woman, Barbara Stanwyck, and conspires with her to murder her husband for an insurance policy payout. And they get paid double, that's the double indemnity, because of an accidental death. And they decide to do set up the death on a train, because train deaths are even more, well, there's not so much query about them. If somebody dies from falling off a train, there's not really a lot. It's not really going to be suicide, because the trains generally over there at that time were not moving very quickly, and so that's not going to be part of wreck the policy payout, but it's going to be a lot easier to collect if the person dies on a train. But as I said, there's differences here between the film and this particular book, and there's more background in this than I remember getting in the film, and the ending is different. I mean, I can tell you this is like 90 years old, so I really got to be able to tell you that in the film, basically. The Fred McMurray character finds out that he's been two-timed by Barbara Stanwyck, and she's just using him to get the payout, and then she's going to set him up. Somehow or other, I think she sets him up by making a phone call that he doesn't answer. But in the book, he's got all that arranged so that he knows where he is and what time it is. And although he doesn't have an answering machine, because they didn't have any at that time, he is able to set up his phone to know when it actually rings, because he puts something under the, because they've got a mechanical bell to ring the phone, and he's able to put something under that so that when the bell rings, it'll fall off, and so that when he gets home, he'll know that somebody's tried to ring him. But that doesn't happen, and so he gets through all of that. But in the end, figures out that she's betrayed him and that he confesses. But in the film, then the police turn up and he's just carted off, and so he's going off to the gallows, and so is she. In the book, the head insurance guy basically says to him, "Well, this isn't very good. It's going to ruin the insurance business if they find out that you've cheated. Here's a one-way ticket to Mexico, leave and never come back." And so it's a fairly ambiguous ending at the end, because he ends up on the boat and then finds out that she's on it as
Yeah, I
well.
see.
And at the end of it, they stand there staring out to the stern of the ship, wondering whether it's a good idea to jump or not. And that's where that's where it ends. So it's an ambiguous finale to this. But by God, it's a good little book. And it's about a short 140, 150 pages, and it just goes. I mean, you could look at it from the perspective to say, well, God, he fell for her really fast. You know, things move so very, very, very quickly at the beginning to get to the point where the crime is then starting to be committed. But you don't really care, because you're on a bit of a roller coaster. And once you get on it, it just shoots and off you go. Great book to read just in one sitting. If you've ever seen the film and you liked it, I'd suggest you read this to get the slightly more background and to get a slightly different ending. One of the great crime classics of the period, really is.
Indeed. Sounds good. All right. Well, this is going to be very much a change of pace from what we've been talking about so far, because this is I'm going to talk about a non-fiction book, but it does connect with the first book that we talked about, because this is called Alien Oceans, and it's by Kevin Peter Hand. So it's an excellent piece of non-fiction science writing, which is discussing the prospects of finding life in the solar system outside the Earth, concentrating on the new understanding that several moons of the larger planets may have oceans of liquid water beneath thick crusts of ice. So the author is I think, a really excellent writer for a popular audience, and he sets out the evidence we have so far, which indicates that moons of Jupiter like Europa and Ganymede have deep oceans of salty water beneath the frozen outer surfaces which we see. He explains why such moons, even far from the sun, can be warm enough inside for liquid water to exist. He raises the prospect that some of these oceans may be in contact with a rocky core, raising the prospect that hydrothermal vents may exist at the bottom, which could provide life with nutrients, as they do in Earth's oceans. So he describes the underwater expeditions on our own planet, which discovered such oases of life on Earth, thriving colonies of living creatures far removed from any light coming from the sun, but subsisting on the chemicals and energy coming from these hydrothermal vents. Now, he himself has participated in such deep dives, and in fact, the book opens with a really dramatic passage, which I can't resist quoting. Perry knows I like quoting things. So this is the very start of the book. We were stuck on the bottom. Batteries were running low. Our air was running out. We had no way to communicate to the other submersible or to the team on the boat some 10,000 feet above us. We were nestled in the metal sphere of our tiny submersible, perched on some rocks at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. This was my first trip to the ocean floor, and it had the makings to be my last. I think it's a great way to start a book.
Ooh, good stuff.
Yeah. So he extends this experience. They need to obviously get out of that situation. He extends his experience and knowledge to explain why there is every likelihood that such vents exist on icy moons, not only in our own solar system, of course, but also around other stars as well. And so perhaps the most common habitat for life in the universe is in such places, and life on the outer surface of a planet, the rarity. So I found it a really interesting book, and I learned a lot about planetology, biology, and our understanding of how life functions and evolves. It was good. Recommend it.
Good thing to be thinking about. There's a few missions that various countries and organisations are sending up over the next few years that are going to be investigating the moons of Jupiter and Saturn to check to see whether there is actually life there. There's a few of them that have got geysers of liquid water or steam coming up from the planet's surface. And the spacecraft will be able to fly through that plume of liquid water and determine what's in it and if there's anything that might be considered to be life. Now, a lot of people might basically say, well, how can you have a water ocean on a moon that's that far out? Well, the whole point is that the moons are generally ice encased, anything up to 10 to 15 kilometres thick. And as you said, they might have a rocky core. Now, that rocky core is going to be stretched and manipulated by the large planet's gravitational pull. So it acts like a tidal system, and sort of the central bit gets stretched and like elastic. Excuse me. And if you get a rubber band and you keep on stretching it backwards and forwards all the time, it heats up because you're putting a lot of extra energy into it. And so the theory is that the cores might be rocky on the outside, but might be molten on the middle, on the inside. And therefore, they may, in fact, have underground volcanoes. And as you say, with a lot of vents spewing up huge amounts of gases which contain organic chemicals, chemicals and compounds. Yeah.
Well, you've only got to look at the innermost moon, or the innermost large moon, which is Io, or Io, whichever you like to say, which is made so energetic by the tidal forces you're talking about that it definitely has a liquid core, and it's full of volcanoes. It has volcanoes all over the place, nothing but volcanoes. And so if you apply that to the moons a little bit further out, then if they have a water ice around them, then that ice is certainly going to be warmed up in the same sort of way. So, yeah, it's a very interesting book, and I enjoyed reading it. Yeah.
And there's a theory that at least one or two of the moons each have as much water on them as the whole of the Earth does,
more,
because
probably, yeah.
their level of water is just so vastly deep, you know, hundreds of kilometres deep, as opposed to ours, which is maybe goes down 5 to 10 kilometres at its
deepest, yeah.
at its deepest.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's all very interesting, and things we may in fact find alien life, as you say, in oceans around moons, in other parts of the solar system. It's going to be an interesting time coming up.
Yep, so that's my books for the
Or,
time.
all right, well, I'm going to move away from books and have a talk about a couple of films that I've seen recently,
Films.
David.
Yep.
Yeah, films, you remember them, the ones you
Vaguely,
go to in the
vaguely.
cinema. I know you have a problem in the sense that you, as we've discussed with, you can't hear what's being said, and the re sound recording is so murky that you can't follow what's going on. And yes, I can understand that, but I like going to the cinema and having things cranked up really loud and seeing some interesting things. And I've got a couple of films I want to discuss here today, which are interesting, not necessarily. It's not going to be to everybody's taste, as I'll explain. The first of these is John Wick Chapter 4, and as you can tell from the title, this is the fourth film in the series of movies about John Wick, starring Keanu Reeves in the lead role. Now, as a bit of background, John Wick is well, he when the first film starts, he's retired from being an assassin, a hitman for hire, and is living with his wife. But she dies, unfortunately, from some medical condition, cancer possibly. But anyway, she dies, and but she arranges for him to receive a dog as a gift after she's died. So he has this dog, and he's basically. He's looking after it. And then one day, while he's driving his car around, the son of a mob patriarch decides that he likes John Wick's car and wants to buy it from him. And Wick says no. And this guy says, basically, nobody says no to me. And tracks him down and invades the house to try to kill John Wick and get the car. Well, he does end up stealing the car, but he ends up killing the dog as well. And that's it for John Wick, and then he's on a rampage. Now, this rampage has now been going for three films. Well, he cleared everybody out.
He must have really liked that dog.
Well, he cleared everybody out of that, and then he stepped on somebody else's toes, and he had to clear that up. And then he stepped on somebody else's toes, and now he's got to the situation where, as well as the films go on, you realise that he's a member of a sort of an international group of freelance hitmen. Who are controlled by a higher level organization, and the top level of this is referred to as the high table. And by the time you get to chapter four in this, John Wick is basically sick to the back teeth of all of them because they're all trying to kill him all the time, and he decides that he's going to seek revenge and take out the head of the high table, and off it goes. 2 hours 50 minutes, David. And this is a we've got everything that you want in a high action, very violent film. There's not a lot of blood splatter, but by God, a lot of people get killed. It's like an old Western. People get shot and they fall down, right? That sort of stuff. But there's a lot of fights in this. I don't think you'd like this one, but I loved it. It's got very high octane fight scenes, lots of guns being used around all over the place. There's a continuing meme all the way right through of sooner or later somebody picks up a pencil and uses that for violent means at some point or other. There's a relentless series of chase scenes. They use horses and motorbikes and boats and everything under the sun. And there's a fight scene in a crowded nightclub where nobody seems to notice what's going on, although two people are beating the crap out of each other. There's some very innovative camera angles for some of the confrontations in this. And there's lots of Keanu Reeves just being dead-faced Keanu Reeves. So it's all the same as it's been in there before, but here it's all dialed up to about 11, 12, or maybe even 15. I knew that it was going to be about 3 hours, and I thought, God, I'm not going to be able to sit through this. I'm going to end up squirming my way through at the end. No, not a bit of it. I basically flowed through this all the way right through. The film carries you through on this sort of massive trajectory all the way right through. It's just absolutely stunning and fantastic. It comes to its inevitable conclusion. Although there was a post-credit scene which I wasn't aware of, but and I'd left before that, but I've been able to track it down, and that sort of makes sense because there's a one of the characters in this is who is charged with killing John Wick is a blind assassin called Kane, and is played by an actor called Donnie Yen, and he's fantastic. He's just fantastic in this role. He's just so cool, and you sort of think sooner or later they've got to do a film starring him. Hopefully they do, and if they do, I'll be happy to watch it. But I also noted right at the very beginning of this film, there's a shout out to Ned Kelly,
Okay.
where one character says to another, "Well, as Ned Kelly said, such is life," and it's used a couple of times in the film. So that was pretty good. I enjoyed that. That was a nice little touch. So I gave this one 4.4 out of 5. I really, really enjoyed this. The other one I went to see just recently is Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves. This is based on the Dungeons and Dragons role-playing game. So it's a fantasy adventure. And I don't really know what I was expecting when I went into this. Was I going to enjoy it? I didn't think it was going to be terribly much, and I don't really think it is terribly much. I know a lot of people think that's real fun stuff and they really enjoyed it, but it's basically a fantasy adventure that's just attempting to be engaging and funny, and for at least half the film, it just isn't. It isn't funny. You can see that jokes are being made and they're just as flat as a tack. And then when a joke is made, and I went, "Oh," and I laughed at it, and I thought, it was a shock. Bloody hell, they actually said something that was funny. And then there was a couple more jokes in the second half. Maybe they've got a different set of writers for the second half. But whatever the situation is, it picks up a bit in the second half when they actually get down to it. So just like a Dungeons and Dragons role-playing game, you have one particular character, in this case, character who's a bard played by Chris Pine called Edgin Davis, who's attempting to acquire a magical tablet which he hopes he'll be able to use to return his wife from the dead. He rounds up a motley group of characters that come with him, and this is some period after his wife has died and his daughter has gone to live with Hugh Grant's character Forge Fitzwilliam. Now, Fitzwilliam's now become the powerful and rich Lord of Neverwinter, and he's being basically protected by a red wizard by the name of Sophina. And he's the one that has the tablet, and he's the one that Chris Pine's character has got to steal it from. There was. I sort of look at the thing, and there's Dungeons and Dragons. Well, there is a dragon, but he's not really very good, and he's big and fat, and he's old, and anyway, not that flash. He's not a touch on the Smaug from The Hobbit, let us say. And dungeons, they run through a maze a bit here and there and try to work their way through it, but not many dungeons, really. Look, this is probably fun. I would have thought this was fantastic when I was 15. I think it's all pretty familiar. It's sort of rather like, that romancing, remember Romancing the Stone? Yeah, okay. So it's sort of rather like that, where it's, but this is more of a fantasy adventure version of that. That was funny in a lot of ways because it just poked. The Romancing the Stone just didn't take itself seriously all the way right through. The Michael Douglas character just basically poked fun at himself all the way right through this. Doesn't seem to be as much poking as there should be in this particular film. So it's okay, but it's not outstanding. I only gave it 2.8 out of 5. Well made. It's well made, well meaning. But you come through to the end and you realise that there's nothing really much at stake here. We've had a lot of fantasy films and fantasy TV series over the last 10 years, maybe Game of Thrones, where unexpectedly, major characters die. They do not in this film. And you sort of keep holding out, hoping that maybe one of them will. Well, yeah, maybe one of them does, but they all come back, and oh dear. No. So anyway,
There you go.
watch it, watch it. But look, I wouldn't spend your money going to the cinema to watch this. I got it on a cheap day, on a seniors ticket, which was good. I'd suggest you wait for it to come onto streaming and watch it with a pizza and a few beers. And if you can't make it through the first hour, turn it off and you've lost
I
nothing.
don't think you could pay me enough to watch a movie like this. There you go.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, I think we're
I
done.
think
I think
so. I
that's
think so.
it.
So we'll wind it up there.
I think we'll wind it up for this particular episode, David, and we shall be back in a few
Yep.
weeks discussing something else, which we shall decide at some time over the next
Sure. Probably
during the next period.
just what we've been reading, but
Yeah, probably. We haven't really got anything lined up major that we've got to get to. We've got a few things coming up the next few months, but nothing just yet. Anyway, thanks,
Okay,
David.
good.
We'll talk to you next
See you
time.
then. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.